6:30 p.m. And then a special play, audio of a play, I should say, of Crumbs from the Table of Joy. And that's coming up at 7 p.m. in place of Radio GBE. Imhotep Gary Bird will be back at his regular time next week at 7 p.m. on Fridays. This is your listener-sponsored community radio station, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion coming up in place of the WBAI Evening News for today. Stay tuned.
WBAI Pacifica Radio Evening News, this is Extinction Rebellion.
Welcome to the rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio. Woo-hoo! We are so excited to be on the air.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
So as soon as we catch our breath, we can get started. I'm Matthew Kearney.
And I am Elise Lane. And we are happy to be here. We want to start off our show always with just giving a little climate news because we are Extinction Rebellion Radio, and you won't hear climate news regularly on other programs. Mm-mm. So here we go.
So ProPublica is compiling the Trump administration's last-minute regulatory changes, which the Trump administration is hurrying to put into effect before Biden takes over. There's a lot here that's relevant to climate. First up, what they call particulate pollution, also known as soot, also known as small, unhealthy particles floating around in the air that are bad for human beings to breathe. With a regulatory maneuver, the EPA, that's Environmental Protection Agency, wants to lock in allowed soot levels for the next 5 years. That's because a Biden-led EPA is probably going to try to decrease soot levels. So the Trump administration is actually trying to keep more soot in the air. That's not spin on our part. That's just a straight way of describing the policy. When you make it harder to restrict pollution, you are pro-pollution. So this is actually a pro-pollution regulation. So to say it again, the regulation would fix soot limits in the air for the next 5 years, preventing the next administration from reducing soot limits. It might be interesting to get companies who put soot into the atmosphere as part of their business to state publicly their position on this legislation. I'd like to ask them and see what they say. Growing up, I thought pollution was bad, of course, but the way I learned about it, and maybe this is true for other people too, was that pollution just happened accidentally as part of the operations of industry. Or it was really hard to prevent it, and so we end up getting pollution in the atmosphere. So growing up, learning about these things, I didn't get the impression that pollution was a human choice. But it's impossible not to look at this regulation and think that the extent of industrial particulate pollution, also known as soot, is not a human choice. Maybe that was a double negative. You can't look at this regulation and fail to realize that it's a human choice. It is a human choice, is what I'm trying to get across. I would be shocked if this wasn't something that industry had lobbied for. So if that's right, what we have here are industry lobbyists and ultimately the owners of the big industrial companies whose work creates soot. Those people are willing to keep soot in the air if it saves them money, or if it saves them bother in doing so. They don't want to have to bother with a new regulation. So for the convenience of a few, we all end up breathing worse air.
Yes, we do, Matt. We end up breathing worse air, but some of us breathe it more than others. You know, this is the thing. Elevated exposure to soot is disproportionately harming the health of African-American, Latino, and Asian communities. Because as a consequence of deliberately racist policies, these communities are where highways and industrial facilities and incinerators are sited, right? So generally speaking, these polluting facilities are not built in or near primarily white communities. Now, according to an article written last June by Gene Chemnick for E&E News, quote, the Union of Concerned Scientists released modeling last year showing that Asian Americans are, on average, exposed to particulate matter concentrations from vehicle tailpipes that are 34% higher compared with other Americans. And they weren't alone. Soot exposure was 24% higher for African Americans and 23% higher for Latinos. And white Americans are exposed to 14% less soot from tailpipes than the average American, end quote. Now, furthermore, there was a study conducted by Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and other institutions that found that Black people were three times more likely to die from soot exposure than other Americans. So this is information, right, that the EPA has, which means that the EPA is pursuing a deliberately racist regulatory change. It is a regulatory change, in fact, that we have to see as fundamentally white supremacist environmental policy. And the fact that the EPA wants to lock this change in for 5 years, knowing full well that doing so will harm Black and brown communities even more and disproportionately, suggests that this decision is part of the genocidal mania that is driving the COVID crisis and is ultimately, you know, driving our climate crisis.
Here's another element from that ProPublica report where they're compiling some of the environmentally related last minute measures the Trump administration is rushing through. The Trump administration wants to end efficiency standards for shower heads and laundry machines. Now, interestingly, this one isn't supported by the relevant industry. Electricity companies are actually against this one because it will waste electricity. Also, the Trade Association for Washing Machine Manufacturers is against this because they say it's redundant with the cycles already on washing machines. Again, what the regulation is to end efficiency standards for shower heads and washing machines, like for laundry. Now, there are two really interesting things about it. It might sound like a little bitty thing, but I think there are two interesting things about it. First, it's kind of amazing to think that a presidential administration would go to special lengths to pursue this when the industry it affects says, we don't want this. This won't
That's
help us.
Amazing.
We're not asking for this, they say, industry says. And the second interesting thing is that for once, environmental activists and manufacturers, in this case, have the same position on a regulation. We don't often agree with them, but here we do. The only people who seem to want this are ideologically motivated anti-regulation people who want to remove all regulation for the sake of removing all regulation. And these people have the ear of the Trump administration. I can't readily think of another plausible explanation for why you would do it when the industry says they don't want to and when environmental folks say we don't want you to do this either.
Well, he wants to because he can, right? That's the way he's been plodding along over the last 4 years. And just because it seems to be part of his whim around, you know, deregulating everything, I think he's just demonstrating his own power in this situation.
Mm. Yet another thing the Trump administration wants to push through in its final days is drilling in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. Now, the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska is a separate place from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which we're also going to cover on the show at some point. Both of those reserves, two different reserves, both of those reserves are home to some of the same species. The Trump administration wants to open 6.8 million acres of the National Petroleum Reserve to drilling. How big is 6.8 million acres? Well, it's the size of the state of Massachusetts. Lot of land. So why do this now when demand for oil is down, prices for oil are down overall? It also means, of course, that the prices for oil leases are down. If the oil that you can get out of the ground is worth less, then the people who drill for oil are willing to pay, or aren't willing to pay as much for the leases of the land to drill on. So why do this now? Well, the oil, yeah, because the oil and gas that's down there, if there is any, which we don't know for absolute sure, is less valuable. So they have to make the leases cheap. Otherwise, it's not worth it to the fossil fuel companies. The Bureau of Land Management, that's the federal agency who issues leases to drill on federal land, they're offering one set of 445,000 acres in Alaska with bids starting at, are you ready for this?
Unbelievable. Go ahead.
$2 an acre. You can drill in Alaska for $2 on this acre. That figure is according to EnergyNet.com, which is cited in the ProPublica report that we've been talking about.
What else about the news?
That's it. That's it for the news. That's enough for us to sit on and really think about.
So Extinction Rebellion has a book. It's called This Is Not a Drill, an Extinction Rebellion Handbook, published by Penguin in 2019, so just last year as we're recording this. It's a little pink-colored book with chapters by various writers who were involved with the group at the beginning, around the time it was founded in the UK. Now, this is the first and most prominent book-length statement that Extinction Rebellion has made. But it's not just one statement. It's several statements by several authors. And in this, it's like the Extinction Rebellion structure. It's not just one thing. There are many different, mostly autonomous chapters. And within those chapters, there are mostly autonomous affinity groups. And all of them are allowed to take action in the name of the organization. And sometimes rebels see what other rebels do and think, that's not the way I would have done that action. Rebel, by the way, is our name for members of Extinction Rebellion. When we say rebel, we're just saying members of Extinction Rebellion.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same with this book. It's not just one thing. There are different kinds of perspectives here, and they sometimes really disagree with one another. Reading through this book called This Is Not a Drill, one must conclude that there's no one big picture Extinction Rebellion viewpoint. Yes, there are four demands in the U.S., and the other countries have three demands. And yes, those are foundational to the group. And yes, you have to sign on to them to join the group. And we're going to devote a lot of this show, a lot of episodes, to talking about those four demands. But they're principles. They're not a total program. They don't govern every last thing. In fact, they don't directly govern much at all. Like I said, they're principles. So what we're going to do in these next few minutes is look at two chapters from this book and react to them and try to take some general insights from the ways that they are different.
Yeah, I just want to say that it's also crucial to see the show itself as part of that autonomous, decentralized organizing. We are not presenting a total program or making claims of that we present that this is what Extinction Rebellion is all about. We will flow from the principles, the four demands, but that is about all you can really say about what we're going to do here. And you'll find that we are occupying, you know, sometimes the very same place, and sometimes we are occupying different positions altogether. And that's what's part of the beauty of being part of it, of Extinction Rebellion.
This is Matthew Kearney and Ailee Slane. You are listening to WBAI Pacifica Radio. And we are Extinction Rebellion Radio. Today we are talking about the book, This Is Not a Drill.
So for one of these chapters, Tiana Jakut, Robin Boardman, and Liam Gary Balich co-authored a chapter called Building in Action. This is a short piece, it's just three pages, outlining recommendations for climate actions. These authors say they're seeking the sweet spot for protest actions where those actions disrupt but don't cause harm. So, for instance, blockading a bridge is disruptive, but it doesn't directly harm anybody. But blockading a hospital, that would cause harm. So, yes to bridge, no to hospital, for instance. And then there's this idea that we shouldn't have leadership, even for particular actions. So here's a quote from that chapter. Quote, if we are to truly decentralize, the hierarchy must become a web. Instead of a top, there is a middle. That middle is a breath, heart, and information. It empowers instead of commands. We flow organically together like a flock of birds with no one leader, moved by our instincts of togetherness. Unquote.
That sounds very California.
I think there's a lot here. California, UK, wherever you may be. Part of this resonates with my own writings on social movements, and part of it doesn't. I think the metaphor of a web is useful. The quote reads that the middle is breath, heart, and information. That's some of the California speak, I guess.
Yes.
Breath and heart are metaphors. They're not quite transparent to me. I'm from the Midwest, not from California. But information is crucial, for sure. Sharing information is absolutely the way to empower instead of command, as they say. But then it goes further. Quote, we flow organically together like a flock of birds with no one leader, unquote. It's almost like they think everybody is going to spontaneously do the same thing.
Yeah, it sounds very spiritual and almost religious in that sense.
Now, in fairness to the authors, they may have been waxing a little bit poetic here, but like they are, you know, it's a strategy document. So like, let's, you know, it's worth thinking about for a minute. Do we really think that it's going to work that way? I mean, after all, birds don't think for themselves to the same extent that humans do. And humans have cultural differences, differences of background, differences of attitude. We could take this into a deep social theory direction and talk about Rousseau and talk about Durkheim if we wanted. But the basic idea is you would have to have a bunch of people who are all the same in order to have them all see the same information in just exactly the same way, such that they all acted in the same way. Same or very similar life experiences, same cultural backgrounds, same maybe work experiences, similar educations, the same way of seeing things. If that's true, if that's what you have, and it's only people of the same background who see information the same way and therefore all act the same way in response, then can we really trust that everybody will just automatically flow organically together without coordination? And if there's coordination, if no, then maybe we need coordination. And if there's coordination, is there hierarchy? Does it really have to be no hierarchy? Like there's either hierarchy or there isn't, and those are the only two options? Or are there more than two options here? These are the thoughts I had when I was reading this article. And it's probably more than we can fully answer right here, but sure. But I think those questions apply to planning actions, and they apply to other things too. And I think they're worth a lot of thought.
Yeah. So, you know, this flock metaphor, I think, is truly a mystification that shifts our attention away from how power does get exercised within XR and how leaders do emerge in spite of our best efforts. And I think you were sort of alluding to this. But it also asks us not to think about the human bodies involved in XR actions, because that gets us into questions concerning what Nafis Ahmed calls XR's tone-deaf approach to racial, ethnic, and religious diversity. Mm. And to that, we can add, you know, class diversity, gender, geographic diversity, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So this tone-deaf approach suggests that the actions XR builds might actually harm in ways that folks aren't necessarily thinking about. So maybe you won't block the pathway to a hospital, but you'll block working people's access to transportation that takes them to their jobs, like when the XR action did the action in England that with taking over the trains, and, you know, working class people were very upset. You know, you'll get chummy with police officers who early in the day might have stopped and frisked some brothers just for drill. So rather than a flock of birds, I think maybe we should be thinking instead of a web of interconnected communities engaged in actions designed to produce bottom up system change. And so I think, you know, even though I like to wax poetic, I'm a writer myself, I think it's really important when talking about these things to be clear and to really think through some of the more difficult issues rather than sort of glossing them over.
Indeed. I mean, just to pick on an example you were just alluding to, if people have had in their lives mostly positive experiences with police officers, suppose that they're from a community or from a demographic that the police mostly treat well and politely for the most part, they might react to the presence of or certain movements of police or the presence of police at a demonstration very differently than a person who is there at that same demonstration who has had very negative experiences with police, who comes from a community where police are very aggressive with them, comes from a community where police are often violent. And the same person, same people with shared attitudes and shared sense of what is good to do in this situation. I mean, what is good to do overall? What is good to do about the climate crisis might react very differently in the particular situation. So more like web than birds.
Yes. And also it suggests that there needs to be a real clear thinking about diversity of actions that actually reflect the broader social political system in which those actions are taking place. So we might want to think about a diversity of actions that really take into account the diversity of the people who are involved in XR.
Yeah, disruptive actions are going to be something XR is going to do. Oh, by the way, for listeners, when we say XR, that's shorthand for Extinction Rebellion. We all have this lingo amongst ourselves that we're used to, and we sometimes forget that that people outside the group don't know. XR is just short, is just an abbreviation for Extinction Rebellion. So Extinction Rebellion, you know, part disruptive civil disobedience actions is a big part of what it does. But how we do it, how we plan it, what expectations we have of how it should go, of how we should involve people, of how we should think about it in the first place. I mean, these are all things that we have to be very critical about, very thoughtful, deeply thoughtful about. I say that as a way of transitioning to Kate Raworth's piece in the same, another chapter in the same book. Her piece is called A New Economics. Now, she's not just talking about doing disruptive civil disobedience. She's talking about more stuff than that. There's plenty of good stuff in this chapter, especially for people who aren't steeped in social theory already. For instance, she talks about turning consumerist desires into an anti-consumerist direction, as in how do we make the motivations behind consumerism, behind buying stuff, how do we make those motivations get directed toward not buying stuff, toward being more environmental in our consumer decisions, to the extent that we make them at all, in our behavior, in our interactions with physical objects. She raises this as a possibility and doesn't really develop it, but we should have more people thinking about how this could be done. And then there's the point that if economic calculation, like when, if we're just trying to maximize our wealth and that's it, is our sole orientation, or even our primary orientation, that's inauthentic humanity. It's an impoverished type of life. It fits uncomfortably with who and how we as humans really are. So her payoff, her closing thought is, quote, "This is the work of economic rebels to create thriving, regenerative, and distributive economies that can meet the needs of all people within the life-supporting systems of this unique living planet. Now, that's what I call a plan for managing the planetary household in the interests of all its inhabitants," unquote.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I think what might have been interesting with regards to marrying the previous piece with this piece, or thinking about how. So on one hand, she's talking about how we act as consumers, but it might have been interesting for her to talk about what it means for us to exercise our power as consumers in terms of refusing to purchase or refusing or withholding our consumption until, for example, corporations make the right decisions around what they produce, or et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the power that we have is not only just in terms of deciding what to consume and what not to consume, but also withholding consumption as an exercise of power. And that could be an action in and of itself.
Absolutely. It can be a whole slew of actions. It can be a whole set of actions. Exactly. It can be a whole program. There's a lot there. It can be a whole program of actions.
Sure.
So Raworth is proposing an economically based intervention into the climate crisis. Change economic attitudes, change economic behaviors. That's different from blocking bridges. Now, sure, on a general level, they're not mutually exclusive. You could do both, but they're not at all the same thing. They require different programs to achieve, different approaches to actually achieve. As intermediate objectives, they're totally different. Disruptive protest actions, on the one hand, reorienting consumerism, on the other hand. Again, it's not that these sharply contradict, like doing one would block the other, but every hour spent producing one is an hour not spent producing the other. And yet both are Extinction Rebellion.
Yes, both are Extinction Rebellion. And I would say also that both are, I'm always going to step back and look at systems and put these arguments in a larger context with regards to the intersections of race and class and gender.
Amen.
And so I would also say that both are grounded in an analysis that is Western-centric and speaks from, this Western we that dispenses with addressing the unequal consumption of Earth's resources. And so I think, I really enjoy her argument. I really think it's important to think about how we consume and doing less consumption. But, she dispenses with addressing this consumption as part of the legacy of colonialism and the continued practices of colonialism. And so I would want to think about that a little bit more critically. Raworth, for example, writes, "This degenerative industrial system must now be transformed into a regenerative one, an economy powered by renewable energy in which resources are never used up, but are used again and again so that waste from the process becomes food for the next. Nature, of course, has been practicing this art for several billion years. Now human-made materials must mimic this art." Now, I think that's absolutely right. What I wanted to sort of push on this is that, you know, for thousands of years, indigenous peoples have been engaging in regenerative practices in economies that do not merely take and take and take, but actually, you know, are in harmony with nature, our natural environment.
This is Matthew Kearney and Ailee Slane. You are listening to WBAI Pacifica Radio. And we are Extinction Rebellion Radio. Today we are talking about the book, This Is Not a Drill.
So, you know, one of the things I came across while I was doing research for this show was this article in which the author asserts that a rebellion, I can't remember the name of the article right now off the top of my head, but that a rebellion against extinction necessarily requires a rebellion against the systems of domination that are setting us on that path. And I think that's exactly right. So part of the ways in which we can think of some of the ideas that she's forwarding here is to sort of ask about how maybe even the solutions she's offering might still be steeped in a framework that continues to, you know, marginalize. It continues to make the Western framework the central framework,
which is often counterproductive.
Well, yes.
I mean, it's often far too limiting.
And I understand the imperative to want to save what you're familiar with. Mm. But if we're thinking about extinction and the processes that are creating extinction, then we have to rethink the whole society in which we live.
Thanks for leaving us with a nice bite-sized, easy way forward. I'm just teasing. But I mean, it, you know, the moment we're in does call forth such thoughts. It does call forth such tremendously sweeping, you know, the consideration of such tremendously sweeping possibilities. So what do we do? What do we do fundamentally? What do we do in reaction to, for instance, these two chapters? So we at Extinction Rebellion have specific demands. We have a broadly unified set of purpose. Fundamentally, we want to lower fossil fuel emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, and save the planet from the heating catastrophe that they're poised to create. And we have some guidelines among our organization for making collective decisions. But in terms of big picture, what is to be done? How are we to do it? What is the first priority? And then from that, the second priority and so on. For all of this, there is no one Extinction Rebellion answer. We're not ideological. We don't have the program of how to get from here to there all worked out, the total consensus behind it. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? I mean, the absence of a total worked out program. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? In my view, it's actually beside the point whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's an inevitability. It's inevitable that we have differences of opinion, differences of emphasis on certain big picture matters. You're not going to, in the 2020s, form a large group of people who all see the climate crisis and what is to be done about it in just exactly the same way. We're not all going to have the same program for what should ideally happen first, then second, then third, for how to handle all the complexities that are going to come up. The climate crisis is too big and too complex to have just one unified thesis with everybody to sign on to. We're not an ideology. We're a shared purpose, and that purpose is combating the climate crisis. And we welcome that which combats the climate crisis.
That's right. And so, you know, it's going to be a multi-pronged effort. And we can certainly, you know, some of us are going to be ideological, and that's okay. But the whole project is to stop the methane in the bottom of the ocean, mm-hmm. the Arctic Ocean, from erupting. I mean, that it really comes down to that. And it really comes down to addressing that in the myriad ways that we can. And so that's where what we want to talk about going forward on this radio program.
That's one of the key tipping points, that methane that is down there locked in the ice. So in this radio program, we take this lesson to heart, and our listeners should understand that the theory of how to handle the climate crisis isn't done. We're still working it out. We have our four demands in the United States and then in other countries that have Extinction Rebellion chapters. It's usually three. But we don't have an all-embracing total perspective like a religion that has an answer down to every last question. We're actively learning. We're still developing now, and we're going to continue to develop in the future. I'm Matthew Kearney.
I'm Ailee Slane.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
Years from now, I'll ride the subway back to Brooklyn. I'll visit Daddy and Goethe. And we'll eat a huge meal of bratwurst and sweet potatoes. And realize that we all escape somewhere. And take comfort sometimes in things we don't understand.
This evening on WBAI at 7 p.m., Crumbs from the Table of Joy by Lynn Nottage.
Years from now, I'll remember my mother and the sweet-smelling, humid afternoons by the Florida waters. And then years from now, I'll ride the Freedom Bus back down home, enraged and vigilant. Years from now, I'll send off one son to college in New England, and I'll lose another to drugs.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.